time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for May 2nd, 2020. I'm not sure why, but May came into Northeast Ohio like March 1st. 44 degrees, gray, and drizzling. It was not very conducive for a bike ride. But as we say here in Cleveland, if you don't like the weather, wait a minute. All that said, I do hope that you are finding ways to get out there. So I was never one of those people who said, this is what I want to be when I grow up. And in fact, I had absolutely no idea that I'd be spending my entire adult life in the bicycle world. But I did find somebody who does know what he wanted to do at a very young age. Matt Pinder is the author of the blog Beyond the Automobile, which probably evokes some interesting ideas for you. Matt holds a master's in engineering from the University of Toronto with a specialization in transportation planning and engineering, and he's passionate about improving the way the world moves, and bicycles are a huge part of that. Matt will be with me in a moment. We'll take our break and come back with a few news items before heading out to Sacramento to speak with Kelly O'Mara. She's the editor-in-chief of Triathlete magazine. Her recent article, Will Triathlons Come Back This Year? And What Will They Look Like? Was just published on April 29th. Those are two huge questions, and while we don't have a crystal ball, Kelly's been talking with athletes, race directors, and sponsors as pools stay closed and events are either canceled or postponed. So my first guest, Matt Pinder, currently works as a senior designer for Alta Planning and Design, a consulting firm dedicated to designing communities that are more friendly and safe for people traveling by bike and on foot. He contributes planning, design, and engineering skills to a variety of projects in communities across Canada, including Ottawa, Toronto, and Halifax. Hi, Matt. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. I'm really excited to talk with you. We do a lot of the kinds of podcasts that we're going to have today with people like Chuck Marone and Jeff Speck. And I love talking with planners. I love talking with designers. And I love your sort of perspective on things from what I've been reading. So can we start with your background? I take it you grew up in Canada.
Yeah, sure. So I actually grew up in a very rural area. I had a childhood that had a lot of freedom. I had a lot of really great memories riding around on my bike on four-wheeler pathways in my neighborhood, going exploring and riding to the store, which was a big adventure because that was 5 miles from my house, going to the lake at the end of my street for swimming lessons. And I think that's one of the things that's kind of led me to where I am now. I really learned the value of having childhood with a lot of freedom and the role of mobility. My parents didn't have to worry about me, and I was able to, you know, go to my friends' houses at an early age on my own.
You know, I had that kind of same experience. I don't know if children today have that experience of being able to get on a bike and just riding away and not having their parents like know where they are every second of the day. But I felt that kind of freedom as a youngster too. How did you become interested in transportation? Your blog is Beyond the Automobile, which is very exciting to me and to a lot of people who listen to this podcast. How did you actually begin to work your way toward the not only the education, but the work you do in transportation?
Yeah, great question. It's a long and meandering path, but I think just sustainability and sustainable transportation were always values of mine growing up. Even when I was old enough to have a car, I still really loved biking to my job that was, 8 miles away in town. And those values stuck with me through my teenage years and then into university when I kept using my bike for mobility. Eventually, I started to meet other people with those interests and other professionals with those interests. And I was able to realize that, this interest that I have in sustainable transportation, it doesn't just have to be, my lifestyle. It could actually be my profession. And I started gravitating in towards the research realm. At that point, I started the Beyond the Automobile blog because I had trained as a mechanical engineer, which wasn't quite so good for getting into transportation. So I decided to showcase my interest through a blog, and that caught me some interest. I wrote about autonomous vehicles, the future of transportation, eventually more walking and cycling focused as well. I had a 3-year stint at a public transit agency called Metrolinx in Toronto, where I learned the value of public transportation. Eventually, I gained a master's in transportation engineering. And I'd say of all of that, the biggest influence that I had on, where I am today in my profession was my 3-week stint in the Netherlands as part of my master's program. And I'm sure you know all about that, Diane, but it was truly a transformational experience to see what cities and urban areas can look like with different transportation values. And after I came back from that trip, I knew that my fate was sealed, and I started looking for companies that specialize in the design of walking and cycling infrastructure. And shortly after that, I landed myself a position at a consulting firm specializing in this called Alta Planning and Design, where I've very happily been working for about 1.5 years.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Matt Pinder. He is a senior designer at Alta Planning and Design. We do know about Alta Planning. He holds a master's in engineering from the University of Toronto, and he specializes in transportation planning and engineering. And when I hear those two words in the same sentence, planning and transportation planning, which I look at as one phrase, and engineering, I sometimes get a little nervous because I know that many urban planners do not see transportation planning the way you do. And I've had this conversation with a lot of people like Chuck Marone from Strong Towns and Jeff Speck, who's just insanely funny to begin with. But, they have different sort of perspectives on transportation in cities and how we really should be designing them. So give us a little bit of an overview of what you do and your basic thinking about riding and walking?
Yeah, great question. So I think thinking differently is really important for being a good practitioner and designer in transportation planning. You have to get yourself, give yourself the space to think beyond what you learn in the traditional education system. When it comes to transportation, especially walking and cycling, human-oriented design is really important, having empathy and an understanding of what various road users need. It's actually quite easy to design for cars when you think about it. The motorist wants efficiency and to move quickly. Those are pretty straightforward objectives and pretty easy to optimize for. What's complicated and difficult is designing for walking and cycling, because these are very human modes of travel. You have to deal with comfort and discomfort and safety and what makes for an interesting environment and what makes for a safe environment for cycling and walking and how different people interact while they're traveling. These are all really things that stem from the realm of social science. And I think when it really clicked for me in my career was when I realized that transportation is just as much a social science as it is an engineering science.
Interesting. Not a way I've really put it together before. It is kind of a social science when we're looking at it from the perspective of somebody who rides or walks, because when you're in that sort of enclosed metal vehicle, you're really not socializing. You're not out there. You're kind of in there, that little tiny whatever that box is.
Yeah. Aside from going fast, the capabilities of a car are pretty limited. It can't move so easily through space. It's pretty big and awkward. Someone traveling on a bicycle has so many more degrees of freedom and ability to move around. And then, of course, someone on foot has infinite potential in urban spaces.
True. So You know, my husband and I talk about an issue that you actually brought up in your blog. I was reading it, and that is the difference between a cyclist and someone who rides a bike. And we talk about this a lot, like what prevents people from getting into quote-unquote cycling. But I guess we've never couched it exactly in the terms of, I'm a cyclist, I just ride a bike. I mean, we talk about that, but the way you put it made more sense to me. What do you see as an answer to seeing more of people who just ride a bike and not having them wear Lycra or join a club or get on Zwift? They're just riding a bike.
Great question. I actually didn't realize this myself until probably my early adult years, but the term cyclist actually invokes a pretty strong stereotype in a lot of people. It kind of invokes this idea of this, you know, this well-trained, seasoned, efficient person who cycles very fast and has a lot of gear and preparation and a helmet and is usually a fit adult who's very capable and someone who's done a lot of preparation to be in that position of riding a bike. It's you know, the term that we use to describe people who are riding in the Tour de France. The alternative term or the secondary term of people who ride bikes, I think goes back to that theme of empathy that I mentioned earlier. It's trying to create more understanding that this is just someone who is currently using a bicycle as their mode of transportation. It may be part of their identity, but it may also not be part of their identity. In fact, in parts of the world where the majority of people ride bikes, most people do not consider themselves cyclists. It's only in North America where cycling is a rather minority form of transportation currently that it is a strong part of people's identities that they ride a bike. And Chris and Melissa Bruntlett wrote this excellent book called Building Cycling City. They discuss the two types of terms that the Dutch use for people who ride bikes. There's, I believe, the fietser, that is the person who rides a bike, the casual, you know, person using a bicycle for transportation. And then, it's escaping me, but there is another term that they use that is distinctly for the racing cyclist or the sport cyclist. And, you know, just the fact that they have two very distinct terms, it really draws the importance of differentiating between those two. And when we are talking about getting more people on bikes and cycling as a form of transportation, we should be using the people riding bikes term, I think.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Matt Pinder. He's the senior designer at there's probably more than one of you at Alta Planning and Design. And he specializes in transportation planning and engineering. And he did do a study in the Netherlands, which of course, you know, once you go there and you see the way things are, it's like you can't unsee it, right? It's just the way it is. So you have a lot of really, that was a really interesting description. I want to get the name of that book from you after we're done having our conversation so that I could see it. I haven't heard of it before. So I also wanted to talk about something on your blog, and there are actually quite a few things, but this topic I thought was really interesting. And one is about closing the streets or changing the way our streets are during the pandemic. And the other is about the need for traffic engineers at these times. So they sort of go together. They need to be put into context. So tell me about what you think about closing streets right now, which some cities are doing. They're changing the way their streets are, and about the need for traffic engineers.
Sure. So the first article that I wrote is called Should We Close the Streets? And I tried to write this in a pretty sensitive way, given that on April 2nd, when I published this, things were moving and changing pretty rapidly. So I wanted to have a fairly neutral view of this big question that many cities were asking themselves. There's a lot of pressure. There continues to be today on April 30th of tensions in cities between people who want to be able to walk around and social distance in the midst of a pandemic, with cities that seem to have an excess of street space right now, given that traffic volumes are really down. So being someone who does spend a lot of time on Twitter, I do see a lot of conversations focused on this. And there's been a handful of cities that have really come out as champions of this repurposing of the transportation landscape to support social distancing and walking and cycling. And at the other end of the round, there have been cities that have, you know, firmly planted their feet and said, we're not going to change much. So this article was really an exploration of those two viewpoints and trying to create empathy for both sides, understanding why cities should or shouldn't close the streets in response to pandemic and people needing more space. And, you know, cities that don't do anything do have a good reasoning behind it. There's friction, of course, saying we're going to create more space for people on the streets. There's a risk that that could draw people and create crowds that are obviously very undesirable now. And I could have written a whole other post about this and how interesting it is that we associate so strongly closing a street with drawing crowds of people. And it's really because any time that we do close a street, it is for the purpose of drawing a lot of people. We close streets so rarely that it's always for a festival or a big event. And I'm not surprised that naturally cities are nervous when we're asking them to close streets and they don't want crowds of people. It's kind of it's a reverse psychology almost.
So interesting. Yeah, it's true. In Cleveland, we have like a gazillion food festivals, all of which, of course, have been either postponed or canceled this year. But you're absolutely right. They draw enormous crowds of people. Do you see any reason to change street structure right now so that maybe you aren't drawing a lot of people, but you're also giving pedestrians and cyclists more space? I mean, it's already there, but giving people the idea that, yes, they're going to take that space and it's okay.
Yeah, I think there's two distinctive viewpoints of streets that have emerged right now. And the first being that streets are a flexible urban space that can respond to different demands of any given moment. And that's what some cities are doing, is they're repurposing how streets are allocated right now in response to the demands of needing more social distancing and people wanting to walk and cycle more. And then the alternative, or the second philosophy of streets, is where political lines are drawn in curves and paint, and any type of budge or change to that is an intense, furious political battle that lasts months and usually ends up much more politicized than it needs to be. And I do believe that many cities are stuck in the latter camp, and this pandemic, this opportunity to see streets as more flexible has kind of drawn attention to that. And for better or for worse, these cities will likely not change much as a result of the pandemic. But the former category of cities are coming out very boldly and making big changes that very well could last beyond the pandemic and are giving people a different way to imagine what their streets could look like. And, you know, to plug the name of my blog, to think beyond the automobile.
Very, very interesting stuff. We're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Matt some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. And if you're just joining me, we're speaking with Matt Pinder. He is a senior designer at Alta Planning and Design. He holds a master's in engineering from the University of Toronto, and he specializes in transportation planning and engineering. He's got an outstanding blog called Beyond the Automobile, and it's got some great articles that he's written. And we just were discussing about whether or not cities should close streets during the pandemic to cars and open them up more for cycling and walking, and whether that might stick in the cities that are doing that after the pandemic is over, which at the rate it's going could be heaven knows, 2 years. I don't know. But anyway, I'd also like to talk about something you actually brought up about autonomous cars. You have a really interesting take on it. We know Elon Musk wants to see cars just driving around by themselves all the time. We know there are issues with them. Do you think that the autonomous vehicles are going to be something of the for the future that are going to work?
Yeah, so I have mixed feelings about autonomous vehicles, but I will start with saying that I am an avid reader of science fiction, and I love reading science fiction. And I always pick up on how they portray the future of transportation in these sci-fi novels. It's never usually the focus, but it's always underlying there. And something that I do see consistently in the future in science fiction is autonomous vehicles. I think it really is inevitable. I'm not sure when it will happen, but it is inevitable that we will get cars that are capable of operating themselves. And I'm actually really excited about that for two major reasons. The first being that it will lead to, by and large, an end to automobile ownership. And the exciting part about that is that it will drastically transform the makeup of our cities that are so focused today on providing parking everywhere that people need to go. As soon as you can use a car, just as you use public transportation, the need for parking capacity at destinations and at houses and on streets everywhere will change rapidly. And people will start to see automobile travel as service rather than an expensive device that needs to be bought. Something that people spend to the tune of $9,000 a year on. Can you imagine if people had that money in their pockets or were spending just a fraction of it to get around? And the second part that I'm really excited about is that humans will no longer operate vehicles when they are autonomous. And we know that humans are full of opportunity for error. Humans like to drive fast. They like to eat while driving. They like to talk on the phone while driving. And we have made so many efforts over the years to correct these dangerous behaviors. And we have made some, but not a tremendous amount of progress. The rise of distracted driving in the last few years has led to more collisions and more deaths than we would like to see. I really do think that as long as humans are operating vehicles, there will be a tremendous number of collisions, and the opportunity to automate vehicle travel can drastically make our roads safer and more comfortable for people to walk and cycle in whatever mode of travel that they choose.
Those are such good reasons. I really like the front end of that too. The whole idea of not owning a car, freeing up all that, you know, of course, insurance companies wouldn't like this, but you know, we're talking insurance rates, we're talking all kinds of money. And a lot of young people don't really want a car. It's just like not owning a home. It's a huge responsibility and a huge amount of money. Wow, interesting. So I always think twice about making this comparison, but I'm going to do it anyway. You did spend some time in the Netherlands, as you said. Are you seeing any of the ideas that the Dutch seem so willing and able to implement being incorporated in any of the projects you're currently working on in Canada?
Great question. And another important piece of my background that I haven't mentioned yet is that I have spent time in cycling advocacy. In a few of the different cities I've lived in, I have been a member of the local cycling advocacy group, and I've led local chapters, and I've really come to understand the process for how change works in cities. And as much as professionals like to say that we are leading the change, we are leading redesign of streets, change really comes in democratic societies from people wanting change, and then from community groups organizing and demanding that change. Something that happened in the Netherlands in the 1970s that more and more people are reading about is that people demanded change in the way that their streets were designed. People and children were getting killed at record numbers. And in response to that, people gathered and they formed protests and movements that ultimately led to drastic change in their society. And fast forward now 50 years from then, we've seen that change to philosophy of street design play out. every time that the Dutch reconstructed an intersection or a street, they built it safer and they built it more oriented towards those new values. And what we're seeing now that I'm really excited about in North America is much of that same movement. We're hearing a lot about safe streets and road safety and Vision Zero in ways that we haven't heard before. Citizens are organizing and they're demanding change, and they're demanding that cities value differently how they design streets, that speed be taken into consideration, that human lives be more taken into consideration, that safe and comfortable travel for people walking and cycling be more taken into consideration. And the results of this change in mindset that are happening today will play out over the coming decade, just as it did in the Netherlands. And as an advocate and as a professional, it is I very much want all this change to happen right now. But the reality is that the values need to change first, and then it takes decades for that change to be played out on streets, because cities have limited budgets and they only reconstruct roads every 20, 40, 60 years. But when we change the values that our road design is based on, we change how those redesigns happen every time that they're happening. And I'm really excited in particular to be living in the city of Ottawa right now in Canada, where there is a lot of public pressure to design streets differently, and the city is taking it seriously, putting resources behind road safety programs and designing safe, separated cycling infrastructure when they reconstruct roadways. Every construction season that passes by every year, more safe walking and cycling infrastructure gets added in the city, and that will begin to pile up as the years continue. And I am confident that a couple decades from now, our North American cities could look like like Dutch cities, if that is something that we continue to want.
Once again, let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Matt Pinder. He is a senior designer at Alta Planning and Design. Such interesting. You may have just wrapped it up, because that's what I wanted you to do, was sort of take the long view. And you just did that. And I'm hoping that you're right. I am a lot older, so I don't know. I'm looking back here in Northeast Ohio at some of the advocacy that I got involved with many, many, many years ago, like three decades ago. Some of that stuff is just coming to fruition now. Some of these paths that go through our downtown, for example, are finally getting hooked up together. But it's exciting that you see that in the future. Well, since you did answer that, and I was going to ask you what the long view was, I'm going to ask one more question that I didn't originally tell you I was going to ask, but it's one that we've had conversations on the show about before, and I didn't read your answer, so I'll be interested to hear what it is. What's your take on helmets? You actually say something about helmets. Should helmets be mandatory? I have the answer, my guess is, without even reading it, we agree, but tell me your take on helmets.
Yeah, I have a clear view on helmets, but I took a long way to get there, and I've actually done a fair bit of research on it as part of my master's degree too. I did one of my term papers on that very topic. And in short, mandatory helmets, I believe, helmets should not be mandatory. I do agree that helmets have the potential to reduce the chance for head injuries for cyclists, so it is smart to wear a helmet. But going the route of requiring that people wear helmets and then punishing those who do not only serves to counteract our efforts to increase rates of cycling. And this is what has been seen in countries like Australia, where mandatory helmet law has been present for a long time. And yes, helmet compliance and helmet usage in that country is very high. It is above 90%. Almost everyone who cycles wears a helmet. But the fine for not wearing a helmet is exorbitant. It's something over $300 or $400. So there's a huge penalty attached to not doing this. And you have to think about the equity considerations of something like that as well. What if someone has access to a bicycle but not a helmet? What kind of state are they in life? And can they afford a helmet? And should we be penalizing someone so heavily for such a thing? I have reflected on this as well, from traveling to the Netherlands and back to here, where, of course, the Dutch don't wear helmets. You'll be very hard-pressed to find anyone other than a sports cyclist in the Netherlands who's wearing a helmet. Even most of the time, children don't wear them. When I lived there or spent time there for a few weeks, I grew accustomed to that, and I really enjoyed, honestly, the freedom of not wearing a helmet and the added convenience of not having to carry it everywhere I went. But sure enough, when I came back to North America, I reacclimatized, you could say, to the state of cycling here, and I went back to wearing a helmet eventually, because we haven't designed our streets to the point of safety that the Netherlands has. I do think that it is something that we should be paying attention to over time, not requiring, but monitoring the helmet rates or helmet usage in our cities, because I think it can actually be an important indicator for how well we're doing in designing safe streets. I think the, not necessarily the goal, but if we consider helmet usage as an indicator, if helmet usage goes down, I would argue that that means we are doing a better job at protecting people with infrastructure, and those people are now feeling comfortable enough that they don't need to use what I would consider the last resort of protection, which is foam around your head. We should be doing absolutely everything we can to protect those people before they need to use that as their form of protection.
Well, we certainly agree. We already know that most of the studies show that when you mandate helmets, ridership goes down. I mean, that's just a fact of statistics, but your explanation was really interesting. Well, Matt, this has just been a wonderful conversation, and I appreciate you taking time to talk with me. I hope I can get back to you again for some of the other things as you continue to write on your blog. It is called Beyond the Automobile, and it's pretty simple. It's beyondtheautomobile.ca, because Matt is in Canada. And I hope you have a, I think you're in Canada to help your parents. Like, you're at home?
I talk to my parents pretty frequently, okay. But no, I'm living with my fiance in our own place in Ottawa.
But you're working from home.
Working from my apartment, yeah.
Yeah. And aren't we all? Well, thank you again for talking with me. Matt Pinder, Senior Designer at Alta Planning and Design. Thank you so much. If you're interested, you can go to his blog, beyondtheautomobile.ca. It's something many of us are looking forward to. Have a great day. Stay safe. Stay well.
Thanks so much, Diane.
All right. Bye-bye. Matt Pinder joined me from his home in Ottawa, Canada. If you are interested in his work, especially his blog, you can log on to beyondtheautomobile.ca. There you can read his articles, learn about his background, and watch some of his media appearances. So let's take a break, and when we come back, I'll have a few news items for you before we speak with Kelly O'Mara from Triathlete Magazine. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. In an effort to pivot from their usual race-promoting and regular sales, Goo Energy Labs has donated more than 65,000 product packages to more than 175 hospitals, medical care facilities, fire departments, police departments, and other first responders across the country that are going above and beyond to keep our communities safe and save lives during the COVID-19 pandemic. These critical roles require stamina and endurance, and Goo is honored to feed the need to move and help to support these frontline heroes during these critical times. Quote, "People on the front lines are taking huge risks to take care of the rest of us. Their hours are longer than ever, supplies are limited, and the value of having energy is at an all-time high, said Goo Energy Labs marketing manager Dermon Martinez. We have tremendous respect and gratitude for all frontline workers whose efforts are immeasurably vital. While our Goo family knows that our care packages are only a small token of our appreciation in the grand scheme, we've been so grateful to hear some truly amazing stories that have stemmed from our donations. To provide energy to responders on the front lines of the pandemic, Goo sent 41,040 servings of energy chews and 15,552 energy Stroop waffles, ultimately providing more than 6.5 million calories to help keep responders healthy, energized, and focused. Goo also sent 7,800 hydration drink tabs to help workers maintain good hydration and 1,000 bottles of probiotic capsules to mitigate the effects of high stress by promoting the growth of beneficial gut bacteria to support the immune system and help digestion. With this modest donation from their Goo Gives program, Goo Energy Labs wants to celebrate all of the amazing efforts of first responders and frontline workers. Well, good on them. Nice job, Goo. Got your mask yet? Or are you looking for that just right mask? Well, you can make your own by following Jan Hein and Natsuko's design at ReneeEarthCycles.com blog. The original design is by Ostrich, and there are step-by-step instructions. But if you don't want to make one yourself, Jan is making them available at a very reasonable price when you order other items from his online store. Me? Yeah, well, Brian's mom is a true seamstress. I'm wearing one she made me. I'm lucky if I can sew a button on a shirt. So is another bike boom coming to the U.S.? I guess that remains to be seen. I spoke with one shop owner this week, Danny at Lincoln Cycles in Goshen, Indiana, who has been crazy busy, and I know there are others who are also struggling. It turns out that 50 years ago, when the last bike boom hit the U.S., 15.2 million bicycles were sold in 1974, the likes of which we've never seen since. This is according to a new article in Bicycle Retailer, where Alan Fine and Lee Katz, the original founders of Turin Bicycles in Chicago, look back on the good old days. I'll link the article on our Facebook page for you. So you might remember that last week we mentioned Issue 11, the ballot initiative in Summit County, Ohio, that would maintain and improve bike trails managed by Summit Metro Parks, including the Bike and Hike Trail, the Freedom Trail, and portions of the Ohio and Erie Canal Towpath Trail. Why, yes, this measure passed. It was a whopping 73% yes to 27% no. The measure is expected to generate $21 million annually for trail improvements over the next 9 years. That's really good because we use those trails all the time. So last but certainly not least, it's National Bike Month. Lauren Jenkins from the LAB says, quote, whether you're riding for fun, fitness, or with family, or taking essential trips to work or shop, you are part of a movement for safer streets, connected communities, a healthier planet, and happier people. Share photos of your solo or family rides on social media using the hashtag BikesUnite, and share the joy biking brings you. By sharing your, quote, reason to ride, end quote, on social media and encouraging friends and family across the country to go by bike, we can experience the joy of biking together even as we shelter at home apart. It will be like we are taking the largest group ride photo in history. Pretty interesting way of looking at it, but why not? Hashtag Bikes Unite. So let's take another break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Kelly O'Mara from Triathlete Magazine. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back. I'm Diane Jenks. This is The Outspoken Cyclist. We don't talk a lot about triathlons on the show, But I think what is happening with the sport is just another indication of the disruption in what we know and have perhaps taken for granted for many years, and is affecting yet another aspect of our lives. Kelly O'Mara is the editor-in-chief of Triathlete magazine, and this week her article, Will Triathlons Come Back This Year? What Will They Look Like? Delves into some of the thinking and planning that is going on in that sport. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Sure, no problem.
Well, you penned an interesting article for Triathlete magazine. You are, after all, the editor-in-chief. You can do that. Will triathlons come back this year? What will they look like? Two great questions and with huge ramifications. So let's start with some of the basics, if we can, about the sport. It's been a while since I was involved in triathlon intimately. Can you sort of give us some demographics of men, women, and how many events there usually are on an annual basis in the U.S.?
Oh, sure. How many events is a little tricky because it depends on like what you count and how you count it and all that. But I think it's like a few hundred is how they usually measure it that are licensed by USA Triathlon. And at this point, everything in the U.S. has been canceled through the beginning of June, more or less. Probably like through the end of June. It's hard to say for sure. And I mean, triathlon, demographically speaking, you know, broad strokes here, is like two-thirds male, slightly wealthier, slightly older. There's been a lot of effort to change that to get it to be like less male and a little younger, but it is what it is, right? Like that's who does it. And yeah, and I think right now, like what everyone's trying to figure out, not just in triathlon, but in cycling and running, is when those races are going to come back, if they're going to come back, what will it look like? You know, all those big questions.
And those are the big questions. So what, besides the fact that clearly we have this pandemic, what are some of the barriers you're hearing from both organizers and from perhaps athletes to whether people will actually participate this year?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the pandemic is the big one. And so in the U.S., obviously, the big question is, like, what are the restrictions? Because they vary so much from state to state, which I think is what's making it very tricky for race directors, because putting a race on in California is going to be wildly different than putting a race on in Florida for the next few months, at least, because the rules just changed so much. A friend of mine who does, like, labor law sent me this list of all the different rules for masks, just for who has to wear a mask and how they vary from state to state. And they're very specific in terms of like legalese and stuff, and it changes. So that's 50 different kinds of rules. And so that's, I think, what's like a really big barrier is just that uncertainty and just not knowing, because it's really hard to plan. Like triathletes, you have to train. You have to train to do a triathlon. And if you don't know if a race is going to be happening in September right now, let's say, like you just don't know if that race is going to be on or not, it's really hard to plan ahead and to train and to book your flight and to book your hotel and to like put out all that money and time when you don't know if it's gonna, you know, end up being canceled. I think that's the big thing for everybody right now, is kind of this uncertainty. If they just knew things were going to be canceled, they'd move on, they'd figure out, you know, they'd come up with some other goal, they do virtual races, but they don't. And so that's been a big obstacle. I think the other big obstacle kind of that we're all seeing, and maybe this is less true in cycling, is pools are closed right now. A lot of people don't have a swim option. So when we do come back to racing, you're going to need some amount of time for people to be able to get back in the water before a race, or it's just not going to be safe, right? Like we can't throw people who are new swimmers or beginner swimmers into a mass start situation or a rolling start or whatever that it's going to be without having given them some time to prepare. So that's definitely a big concern I'm hearing from a lot of athletes. And the money is obviously just like a concern. You know, they spend a lot of money to get ready for an Ironman, and some of that, you know, you're not necessarily getting refunds on your flights or your hotels or your training. So
let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Kelly O'Mara. She is the editor-in-chief for Triathlete magazine. Big questions, big questions. So, yeah. And not just athletes, we also have sponsors, race directors, venues.
Right.
You know, people may or may not realize what goes in, especially to a three-event event. where you have swim, bike, run, you have all these transition areas and you have all these rest stops, and it's crazy. How are sponsors viewing the season? You know, a lot of women's, well, two of the top women's cycling teams have lost all their sponsorship for 2020. They've just had their sponsors pull out. So yeah. What are you hearing about sponsors this year?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, you know, triathlon's going to feel a lot of the same thing cycling is, which is just, you know, a lot of advertisers, a lot of sponsors, a lot of companies in the space, you know, either they are struggling themselves right now, so they just don't have the money, or they are struggling with the uncertainty, so they're trying to, you know, hold on to their money just to wait and see. And so there kind of are two sides to the sponsor question. There's the people, the sponsors, the brands, the companies that back races, you know, that will do big expos at a race event. And a lot of them spend a lot of money planning to be at expos and at races and like on course, and those things aren't happening now. And so that's, I think, tough for them. And they are struggling. I've been hearing from a ton that, you know, they're struggling, and some of them are pivoting. Some of them are making PPE or, you know, new gear, and some of them are doing fine. Like, you know, the indoor cycling is doing great right now. So there's certainly like things happening. And then the other half of it is obviously like the pro athletes, like you mentioned. And triathlon is not a team sport. It's very much like individual pros have their sponsors. And I think it varies heavily between, you know, the top pros who are on very good sponsorship deals and are doing okay right now because they are still connecting with their fan base. They're doing a lot of podcasts, a lot of Facebook live chats, a lot of at-home workouts, you know, and are still really providing a value to their sponsors. And then the people who didn't have as big sponsor contracts and relied more heavily on prize purses, those people obviously there aren't prize purses. So they're having a hard time, I think, right now.
Yeah, I would guess so, for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, so you're in the publication business. You're in the journalism business. And I know that publications actually are being looked to for information right now. So how is Triathlete Magazine doing?
Yeah, that's what we've seen a lot. I think at first a lot of people thought, you know, we would see a big drop in our readers since there were no races and there were no events, but that just hasn't been the case. Our readers definitely want information. We've seen a huge influx of people like wanting information about how to train safely, about, you know, how to train for a swim when there is no pool, about how to do indoor work, how to stay motivated. We've done a lot of stuff on nutrition and like mental strategies, you know, stress, like coping with stress during this. And so we have seen a huge amount of interest and readers and feedback just because people want that right now. And so we've just kind of, you know, changed our, like, we're not covering races. We're providing our athletes with like what they want and what they need, which is a lot of questions. Like a lot of people have a lot of questions that they want answers to. So,
well, that brings up a question to me about getting new people into the sport, which I didn't think mm-hmm. about until right now, but it seems to me triathlon, if you've looked at it for a long time and said, yeah, I don't think I want to do that, that there actually might be an opportunity to introduce new people into triathlon because of the nature it's going to all start rolling in. There's not, no pun intended. There won't be any like hard start to the season or hard stop to the season. A race might pop up here or there as things loosen up. Do you see that as an opportunity for people to maybe try it out?
Oh, for sure. I mean, what we're hearing anecdotally is, you know, there's a coming running boom and a coming bike boom, like more people than ever who have never... My sister bought a treadmill recently, and I don't think she's ever run more than 3 miles in her life, right? It's just like people are wanting to do stuff to get active, to keep moving through all this. And so what we're hearing anecdotally is a huge number of new runners, a huge number of new cyclists, and we're hoping, we're imagining that that will continue as, you know, we kind of ease up restrictions and come out of this. And I do think what we're going to end up seeing is a lot more small local races this year, like a fewer, you know, you're probably not going to be traveling to Europe for a big race this year, likely as you're going to be doing like a little thing in town, which is probably going to give people an opportunity to try like a local triathlon now that you took up running, now that you got your bike out of the garage, like why not do like your local race? So
So that brings up something I hadn't thought about for a long time, and that is biathlon, that you actually could do some run, bike, run things again that were huge. I don't know how big they are now, but maybe you need to drop swimming out for the short term. Maybe people would consider doing that. There might be a way to do it.
Yeah, duathlon. Biathlon is shooting and skiing. Well, that's duathlon is running. Yeah.
Biathlons, but you're right, of course. Biathlon is shooting and skiing, which is a little different, but go ahead.
A little different. Yeah, but duathlon, I mean, right now there's been a lot of virtual events, and they're almost exclusively duathlons, of course, because you can't swim. So there's been a lot of, you know, run, bike, run. And so I do expect that we'll see, you know, continue to see more of those. They're a lot harder. Like, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends if you're a good swimmer or not, but run, bike, run is very hard. People don't realize how hard it is.
That you transition, you have to run, then get on the bike, then get off the bike, then put on your well, it's complicated, but it does work. It does work. Because one of the cool things about triathlon is it's a solo sport. It's not a team right. sport, even though there are some events that allow teams. But one person, you know, can do the entire event and never really touch people. How are people talking about doing things like hand up food or water stops? Are you hearing some new things about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's obviously the big question. That's what I was writing about the other day, was kind of what will races look like in the future. And so they're trying to figure out how you logistically do a race while following, you know, best practices, social distance guidelines. And, you know, one perk of triathlon is that we're already used to wave starts and time trial starts. So, you know, because that's going to be a big factor. You know, when you talk about like fondos in cycling or like mass marathons, you have these huge fields that are all crammed into a corral. Triathlon is more used to wave starts already. So, you know, spacing those out so that people aren't all on top of each other. So that's going to be a thing that we see like more of if we get back to racing. It's kind of like spacing people out, smaller fields, like longer amounts of time to start so that not everyone's like crammed into this little gate. And then, yeah, like decreasing the point where you might be touching people. Those potentially means like carrying your own food or your own water, means like fewer aid stations, you know, not like, you know, like in triathlon, usually you finish and, you know, someone like gives you a hug and a towel and a medal. Like that probably won't happen.
You know, probably anymore. Not. I'll probably hand you not. A mask.
So it's just stuff like that, you know, which I think will be tricky and difficult for sure to figure out all those questions, like how you do that. But I think marathoning is also trying to figure that out right now. And there's all kinds of like mathematical models to, you know, if we space everyone out 6 feet, like how long does that take? What does that look like? So.
Yeah. Well, then you'd need lanes for people to pass 6 feet away, mm-hmm. you know, as people, wow, it is really, really complicated. So if you were to have a crystal ball and let's say testing was in place and trace contacting was in place and everybody could figure it out, what do you see as the long sort of view of triathlon? Do you think it will be able to bounce back if given the go-ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I expect triathlon to come back fairly strongly because triathletes are triathletes. They're very gung-ho, they're very type A. They will be back as soon as racing is you know, ready to go. What will be interesting is if this does kind of cause any long-term changes. You know what I mean? Like if we use this as an opportunity to look at how we go about the sport, to think about, you know, what could we do differently? Should we have more smaller local races instead of so many big international events? Like, is that an opportunity here for the smaller race producers to come in? Cause that's not really been a thing in recent years. So I will be curious to see, you know, if that happens now. But other than that, I do expect, you know, triathlon was growing again. Everything kind of struggled, I think, for a few years there, kind of post-recession and stuff. But triathlon was coming back around and growing again. And so I certainly hope that after everything gets kind of leveled out and right coursed, that triathletes come back around. I would imagine they will eventually.
Well, I certainly hope so. It's such an interesting sport. And it's one that I've been sort of peripherally involved with since it began in the 80s. You know, watching everybody watch Julie Moss, you know, crawl right across that finish line. That started the whole thing. Well, we've been speaking with Kelly O'Mara. She is the editor-in-chief of Triathlete Magazine. We are talking about whether or not triathlons are going to happen in 2020, and if they are, what they might look like. Thank you so much for talking with me today. Thanks for writing a great article. If anyone is interested in reading it, it is online at Triathlete. I think it's Triathlete Magazine.com. Triathlete.com.
Yeah,
it was from April 29th. Will triathlons come back this year? What will they look like? Two great questions. Thanks, Kelly. Good luck. And hopefully things will straighten themselves out.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Kelly O'Mara is the editor-in-chief of Triathlete Magazine. If you're interested in reading her article, Will Triathlons Come Back This Year? What Will They Look Like? You can log on to triathlete.com. So I hope you enjoyed the show. My thanks to Kelly O'Mara and Matt Pinder for joining me this week. Last week, I asked you whether you were riding indoors, and if so, were you using any of the online platforms such as Zwift? For the most part, you're actually riding outdoors, resorting to indoor training only when absolutely necessary. In retrospect, I'm not sure I even like that original question. So let's see if this week's question will be more fun. Are you wearing a face covering when you go out? If so, please post a photo of yourself with it on our Facebook page. So thank you for listening. I really appreciate your comments and encouragement for the show. We'll be back next week with a conversation about bicycle highways, and we'll speak with Brad Bingham from Erickson Bicycles. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, stay well, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.